Les colloques du Collège de France.
Good morning, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here and to be part of this really exciting colloquium. And merci beaucoup, Professor Besson, pour la gentille invitation. So if a company mines an asteroid, what law determines who, if anyone, owns the minerals? And who will recognize or enforce that claim on Earth? It's quite a practical question. And until recently, it seemed quite speculative. But these sorts of questions now seem, if not urgent, somewhat pressing. They're rarely discussed in the literature on space law, but I think they are important questions, and they require us to engage with another body of law known as private international law, and that's the body of law that I'm going to be focusing on in my presentation. Now, the central argument of my paper and my presentation is that although private international law has been largely absent from space law debates, it is crucial for resolving cross-border property issues and will play an important role as part of the law governing space mining. Now, the role that private international law should play will, however, depend, at least to some extent, on some more fundamental questions about the sort of property regime which will be recognized in respect of resources in outer space, the big questions that we're all grappling with at this conference. Like some others, I suggest that the best way to explore these questions is to look at our experience with areas beyond national jurisdiction on Earth. And I suggest that there are three different models which could be adopted: a unilateral approach, a cooperative approach, and a collective approach. And that private international law plays an important but distinct role under each of these. Now, as we all know, and as has been well rehearsed already, the legal regime for outer space was primarily developed in the 1960s and 70s, focused on preventing conflict and territorial claims among states during the Cold War era. And space law naturally, in consequence, focused on states and public international considerations, questions of sovereignty, treaty interpretation, the rights and obligations of states. And as explained, the Outer Space Treaty famously frames space as the province of all mankind and prohibits national appropriation of celestial bodies. As we heard from Professor Hober, when astronaut Buzz Aldrin planted the US flag on the moon, it was a symbolic gesture and not a territorial claim. But this prohibition on appropriation is directed to state actors. It doesn't directly speak to the possibility of private rights. Now, of course, as we've already heard, the later Moon Agreement did speak to these issues more directly and prohibited the acquisition of property rights by any private party in connection with celestial bodies, but it's not been widely ratified or accepted as reflecting customary international law. Now, as we've also already heard, this classical body of space law is being challenged by modern developments. The rise of private actors, sometimes carrying out privatized state space programs, but also new commercial ventures like private satellite communication systems. But second, new activities being carried out by those private actors. Space tourism is one that we haven't yet discussed, but raises important private international law questions potentially, but also asteroid and lunar mining, which is the main focus of my presentation. So, of course, these developments raise new questions. My question is, can private actors actually require property rights in space resources? If so, under what law will those rights be recognized internationally? These are questions of policy, of property law, of legal theory, of public international law, but also questions for private international law to contend with, as I will explain. Now, I think private international law is probably not going to be very familiar to many of you, so I'll introduce a little bit its function with a focus on the role that it plays in connection with property. Private international law is a body of law which addresses cross-border private law issues. And it deals with three main questions. If you have a cross-border legal issue or relationship, the question of which courts have jurisdiction to hear any disputes which arise, the question of what substantive law should govern that relationship or that issue, and then if you get a judgment from one court, will that judgment be recognized and enforced in other courts as having sort of finally determined the issues between the parties. Now, I'm going to be focusing just on the second of these issues, the applicable law question, which legal system governs property rights in cross-border or extraterritorial contexts. Now, you might initially think, well, why doesn't each court just always apply its own law? Why do we have these applicable law rules to determine what law applies in a cross-border situation? So this is a very complex question in private international law, but for today we can think of applicable law rules as serving two main purposes. One is to try and identify the most appropriate law for an issue based on the connections that that issue has with different legal systems. And we do this to try and, for example, help judges to resolve cross-border disputes in line with the expectations of the parties and the limitations on state sovereignty. The second goal that we have for private international law rules, for applicable law rules, is to achieve what we might think of as systemic goals. If we have harmonized and coordinated applicable law rules, they provide predictability and security for global markets. They can reduce the economic costs of doing cross-border activity by reducing legal uncertainty. I'm going to illustrate this a little bit further in a second. How do applicable law rules work in practice? Very briefly, there are five main sorts of approaches which are adopted in applicable law rules. The first of these is a territorial rule, which points to some territorial connecting factor. We might say that the law governing a tort should be the law of the place of the tort, for example. Sometimes we rely on nationality. Sometimes we rely on concepts like domicile or habitual residence to connect a relationship to a particular legal system. Sometimes we adopt a rule which is more flexible and open-textured. We say, as our rule, that the law governing an issue should be the law most closely connected to the issue and leave it to the judge to figure out what that is. And sometimes we allow the parties to choose themselves what law governs their legal relationship. It's known as party autonomy that Professor Rasmussen's already mentioned. This happens all the time, of course, in contracts. But it's very rarely considered to be appropriate for property issues or property disputes, and for complex reasons, but largely because of the third-party effects of property rights. Now, these rules are invariably subject to some important safeguards, and the most important safeguard that I want to mention is the public policy exception in applicable law rules. Courts always retain the power, the authority to refuse to apply a rule of foreign law if it's contrary to the fundamental principles of that legal system. Now, for property issues, the almost universal rule is known as the lex situs rule. The law of the place of the property governs questions of title. If we're thinking about movable property, it's also necessary to identify the time that matters, the moment when the location of the property determines the applicable law. And it's when the title which is being asserted is alleged to have arisen. And I think it's helpful to illustrate this with a case, the English case of Winkworth and Christie, Manson and Woods. So this case concerned a collection of Japanese carvings which was stolen from England and taken to Italy, where they were sold to an apparently innocent but not very curious purchaser. That purchaser later brought the sculptures back to England to sell at auction through the auction house Christie's. Now, the original owner discovered this and sued to stop the auction house selling, claiming title to the sculptures. Under English law, the purchaser might be on constructive notice because they failed to make inquiries as to whether the goods were stolen, but under Italian law, the purchaser would get good title. Now, the English court decided that Italian law would apply, because this was the law of the location of the property at the time when the purchaser claimed to have got good title to the goods. Now, this might seem tough on the original owner. His property was stolen in England and later reclaimed in England, but it's Italian law that decides that he has in fact lost title. But the point of principle is that a purchaser should be able to rely on the legal system in which they are buying property. A purchaser in Italy can only be expected to comply with the rules of Italian law. And it would be highly undesirable if their title was affected subsequently by moving the property from Italy to England.
thinking about this more broadly, for global markets to work, there needs to be security of title, and this is ensured by the almost universal application of the law of the place of the property, the lex situs rule. And on this question, private international law is actually unusually coherent and agreed between different national systems. So private international law, and in particular the lex situs rule, forms part of what we can think of as the architecture of the global economy, a form of global legal ordering which seeks to ensure that nationally acquired property rights are effective internationally. Now, importantly, private international law doesn't always align perfectly with public international law ideas of territory in carrying out this ordering. Sometimes we might apply the law of a non-state in some circumstances through private international law, if that's the law the parties would expect to apply. The lex situs rule generally functions well and straightforwardly, but it assumes that property has an identifiable location and that location is within a legal system. So we have two big challenges. One challenge is if we have certain kinds of property that don't have an identifiable location, such as cryptocurrency. Now, that's a discussion for another day, or rather many other days. Challenges also arise when property is located outside any national jurisdiction, as in outer space. And here I'd suggest that the legal treatment of areas beyond national jurisdiction on Earth offer the best potential analogies or models that we might draw on in thinking through these challenges. So the first analogy that we might draw on is to think about property on the high seas. And here I'm thinking about the classical law on property in the high seas prior to the development of the modern law of the sea. The oceans beyond national jurisdiction have long been considered to be a global commons. Historically, two main proprietary issues arose. The first is to do with ships and activities on board ships, so the trading of goods on board a ship in the high seas. This was treated as located at the place of registration of the ship, the flag state system, at least while ships are on the high seas and outside the territorial jurisdiction of a particular state. The second and perhaps more important issue for our purposes is to do with the acquisition of resources on the high seas, so fishing in the high seas. How do property rights arise in fish caught on the high seas? And here, like others, we can go back to Grotius, one of the founding fathers of modern public international law, who spent a lot of time writing about high seas fishing. Now, Grotius didn't actually have any interest in high seas fishing. He had an interest in freedom of the Dutch to trade internationally and for their ships to sail freely. But he was making an argument that if you can fish freely, then you must also be able to navigate freely. The greater implies the lesser. So he spent a lot of time talking about why high seas fishing was justified. And his argument, and this was an argument further developed by Locke, who again we've heard from before in the 17th century, was that fish were a kind of communal property, but a communal property which was capable of being converted into individual property through the labor of capturing the fish. And this would be regulated by the law of nationality of the vessel on which that labor occurred, on which the actual fishing took place. And so they thought, Grotius and Locke thought, that each state could regulate this unilaterally, and the law provided this, and that this wouldn't really matter if you had multiple states authorizing fishing activity, because this was supposedly an inexhaustible resource. And echoes here of the sort of justifications for an open approach in Myers McDougall's work. So private international law played a supporting role here in this traditional law. It recognizes that title acquired on the high seas through fishing would be based on the law of nationality of the ship. And when a fishing vessel landed the port of a different state, they would recognize that title if it had been properly acquired under the law of the flag of the vessel. Now, under the modern law of the sea, this sort of traditional unregulated or unilateral approach has been abandoned. There are a number of different changes which have been adopted under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. But the most important for our purposes is a shift from a unilateral to a cooperative approach. So states are now obliged to cooperate to ensure the sustainability of high seas fishing stocks, largely through regional fisheries management organisations. Private international law still supports title to fish which have been acquired in accordance with flag state law. So in that sense, it still works in this traditional system. But there are now public international law constraints on when states can authorise that sort of activity. These effectively impose collective obligations on states. Now, the law in this context is not very well developed. There haven't been many cases which have actually grappled with these issues, but private international law could and should arguably play a deeper role here, not just in recognising title which has been lawfully acquired, but also sometimes in denying title if fishing has taken place contrary to a state's international obligations, through application of the public policy doctrine that I mentioned before, which has been used in other contexts in private international law where property rights have been obtained contrary to international law rules to deny title to those rights. So it illustrates that in a cooperative system, private international law can serve not just to secure title, but also to challenge title where it might undermine the cooperative rules. Now, the third context that we might look at domestically is the regulation of deep seabed mining. So we've heard a little bit about this already, that Part 11 of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea establishes the deep seabed, the area, as the common heritage of mankind, a familiar phrase, but also provides that no state or private person may claim rights except as authorised by the International Seabed Authority. And in fact, there's an obligation not to recognise any rights that have been acquired outside this framework in the UN Convention on the Law of the Seas. The International Seabed Authority can authorise deep seabed mining. In practice, this happens under the supervision of a state, and it's subject to complex rules which are still being negotiated. The approach here is similar to that which was proposed in relation to the Moon Agreement, and in this context it's experienced similar challenges in being accepted by states. Again, private international law could play a supporting role here, giving effect to these rules, recognising rights which have been lawfully acquired, but also denying rights where deep seabed mining is not properly authorised. And these would indeed seem to follow as a matter of obligation under UNCLOS, because of its obligation not to recognise rights acquired outside the regime. Now, it's important to note that the US, which is not a state party to UNCLOS, has challenged this regime with its own unilateral licensing approach, most recently pursuant to President Trump's executive order of April 2025. And this raises some tricky questions of recognition, in particular, whether states will comply with the prohibition on recognition of rights under UNCLOS in relation to rights purportedly acquired under the US. And again, the public policy doctrine could have an important role to play here. So, returning to outer space, as we've already heard, you know, the Outer Space Treaty prohibits national appropriation, but is perhaps silent or ambiguous on private property and these questions of applicable law. So what role could or should private international law play? Well, drawing on these three analogies, the unilateral, cooperative, and the collective, starting with the unilateral approach, as we've already heard, some states, like the US, Luxembourg, have authorised their nationals to mine and own space resources. This very much resembles the traditional model of fishing on the high seas, it's like the model being proposed by the US in relation to the deep seabed. Title to extracted resources is created under national law, typically just through effective possession of the resources. Now, this raises several key questions. There's the question of lawfulness, the compatibility of this approach with the Outer Space Treaty. does granting private property rights imply a sort of prohibited sovereignty claim? This is quite a complex question, which is in part a question of treaty interpretation and in part a question of legal theory, and we'll hear further from both those perspectives in this conference. There's also the question of the desirability of this unilateral approach, the risk of legal fragmentation, regulatory competition, to echo Professor Rasmussen, which may or may not be thought to be a good thing, flags of convenience, the risk that you have the sort of same regulatory race to the bottom that we've seen in the context of fishing on the high seas, among other kinds of considerations explored also by Professor Stilts. But there's also a question of effectiveness of a unilateral approach. Each state's property law is normally effective only in its own courts, unless it's more widely recognized through rules of private international law. Now, it's perhaps possible for a US space company to take off from US territory, mine an asteroid, and return to US territory without crossing national borders. But it's less obvious to me how a Luxembourg company would manage this. Even in the US case, the US resources would need to travel across borders, or might need to travel across borders at some point. There are, again, distinct and interesting issues if resources are extracted and sold in space itself, for example, to support a lunar colony. It's perhaps slightly less well known that NASA has already entered into contracts to purchase mined resources on the moon as a kind of proof of concept that this can be legally done. This, of course, hasn't actually happened yet, but the contracts have been already signed. A key question then is whether other states will recognize rights acquired under national legislation. This is also a question for private international law. So private international law could, in theory, support a unilateral approach. It could extend the Lex Situs rule, the law of the flag state rule, to the outer space context in the same way as kind of fishing on the high seas. Traditional fishing on the high seas. You can imagine having an international treaty even under which unilateral space mining is accepted and endorsed and security of title is ensured. If you bring back property from a space mission authorized under Luxembourg law and you gain title under that law, you have good title everywhere, even if the property crosses borders, like bringing your sculpture back from Italy. Or this could just become widely accepted in practice and develop through national law. But in the absence of an international agreement on the lawfulness of unilateral space mining, private international law is just as likely to serve a negative role in states which consider these programs as contrary to the Outer Space Treaty, denying recognition to title because it was obtained contrary to fundamental rules of international law and public policy. If we think of the second kind of idea, a cooperative approach, we might think that we could have a regime where states can authorize space mining under different national laws, but there's a multilateral framework which coordinates those authorizations, as in modern high seas fishing, where there's a treaty framework which provides a degree of coordination. The framework could be used, for example, to ensure equitable access, sustainability, conflict avoidance, so that two states don't authorize a mining operation to the same asteroid. So private international law would potentially play a role here, again, in supporting the recognition of rights acquired in accordance with this framework. On the other hand, title acquired outside the framework, for example, through unauthorized mining or when national authorization was given outside the cooperative framework, could be denied recognition as contrary to public policy. And the third approach that we've already heard quite a lot about, the more sort of collective approach. We could have an international authority analogous to the International Seabed Authority granting rights. Resources could be managed as the common heritage of mankind. This is more or less the model which was proposed under the Moon Agreement, but which has not been implemented and would at least be very challenging to get agreement now. Title, in a sense, under this approach would be created and recognized under international law itself. Although perhaps the practice in relation to the deep seabed suggests that the continued need for state involvement, the need for mining operations to be sponsored and licensed by particular states. Once again, private international law could play a supporting role here. It could recognize rights acquired pursuant to an international authorization. But equally, it could refuse the recognition of rights acquired outside the collective regime. In fact, if we did have some kind of collective regime like this, we might expect to see an equivalent of Article 137 of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, where states are required to deny recognition of any title obtained without approval from the international regime. So the role of private international law in the governance of extraterrestrial property is, I think, shaped by the broader legal and policy framework adopted. In relation to these questions of title to property, private international law can act to coordinate title, but that doesn't mean that it's a purely technical or neutral body of law. It reflects and enforces broader policy choices, often but not always in perfect alignment with public international law. Private international law can act both positively and negatively as an enabler or a gatekeeper. As an enabler, private international law can facilitate cross-border transactions or movement of goods if there's consensus on the applicable law. And it could also facilitate and support private property rights under a space mining regime. As a gatekeeper, private international law can deny recognition of rights acquired in violation of international law or fundamental policy. So it can serve both to provide security of title, but also to undermine and challenge assertions of title in a cross-border context. So what role will private international law play in space law? It's likely to be contentious, of course, and it's not clear if private international law will lead or follow in this endeavor. It depends to some extent on whether states will actually be able to agree on a property regime and in consequence potentially agree on private international law rules for space resources. I think it's worth noting that the current lack of clarity on these issues doesn't seem desirable for anyone. Space mining is neither clearly authorized nor prohibited, and it's not clear if effective property rights can be acquired, and this risks undermining the commercial viability of investment in the future of space mining or the protection of space from mining, depending on your perspective. Now, whatever model is adopted, private international law would, I think, have a role to play. Under a unilateral approach, or a cooperative approach, or a collective approach, in each case, private international law can facilitate security of title when it becomes necessary to sort of deal with these the proceeds of mining across borders, but it can also potentially challenge security of title if you have a regime which seeks to limit space mining activity. So it can act as a means of enforcing whichever regime you adopt. Now, I think there's an open question about whether a new international agreement is needed or even possible to achieve these goals, or whether consensus might be something that has to emerge through practice and soft law over time. To conclude, private international law may not have been at the forefront of thinking for space lawyers traditionally, but with new private actors and activities like space mining, private international law is, I think, important to the practical realization of any regime. And so engagement from space lawyers with private international law questions is crucial. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.